Philo Torah Zoom Shiur for Yom Revi'i, Wednesday, the second day of Tammuz, 5786, corresponding to June 17th. Second of Tammuz, 49 years ago, 1977, June, on a Shabbos. There was a terrible accident on Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn. Who needs to be muted? I don't know who. I'll mute everybody. Forgot how to do it. Oh, there it is. Okay. Sorry about that. Second of Tammuz is 49 years ago. There was a terrible accident on Shabbos afternoon. A whole bunch of people were sitting on the benches between both sides of Ocean Parkway. A car went out of control, plowed through a whole bunch of people. I think six people were killed. Three of them were two aunts and an uncle of mine. And my uncle lingered for 2 weeks, and my aunts were killed on the spot. So it's a date that we don't forget in the family. So I want to make the shir le'ilui nishmatam of my two aunts, Sara Shasha, Bat Yecheskel and Miriam, and Brindle Bracha Bas. I don't know their Hebrew names. I only remember them as Charlie and Rose. We call them Grandpa Charlie and Grandpa Rose. They weren't my grandparents, but they were my cousin's grandparents. So anyway, it should be le'ilui nishmatam. Tehillim Kuf. Mizmor Latoda Hariu Ladonai Kol Haaretz Ivdu Et Adonai Besimcha Ba'u Lefanav Birnana Du'u Ki Adonai Hu Elohim Hu Asanu V'lo Anachnu Amo V'tzon Marito Ba'u Sha'arav Betoda Chatzerotav Betehila Hodu Lo Baruchu Shemo Ki Tov Adonai Leolam Chasto Va'ador Vador Emunato. David, you're on double duty. Kuf Kuf Aleph.
Yelamalo, Sasoina, Yala Harim, Ayanimo Ezri, Ezri, me Madana, Yose, Shmaimo Ares, Al Yitain, Lamotraglacha, Ayanum, Shomracha, Ine, Lo Yanum, Velo Yishan, Shomer Yisrael, Adonai, Shomracha, Adonai Tilcha, Ayajiminacha. Yom HaMashemesh lo yakeka v'yareach ba'layla. Adonai yishmar chamikol ra, yishmar es nafshecha. Adonai yishmar teischa vo'echa me'ata v'yad olam.
Kuf Lamed. David.
Shir HaMalos mimamakim pasicha Adonai, Adonai shima b'koli, tianos necha kashuvos l'kol tachnunai. Imavonos tishmar ya Adonai mi yamod ki imcha aslicha laman tivarei ki visi Adonai ki vsa nafshi v'lidvaro ocholti nafshi l'Adonai mishomrim laboker shomerim laboker yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed baharbe imo fedus v'hu yifdes Yisrael mikol avonosav.
Mi Shaberach Avotenu Avram Yitzhak V'Yakov V'Yivarech Et Chayalei Tzava Hagana L'Yisrael V'Et Anshei Kochot HaBitachon HaOmedim Al Mishmar Arzenu V'Orei Eloheinu V'Halochamim Ba'adenu Min HaLevanon V'Ad Midbar Mitzrayim U'Min Hayam HaGadol Ad Levo HaArava U'V'Chol Makom Shehem B'Yabasha Ba'Avir U'V'Yam Yitein Adonai Et Oyevenu HaKomim Oleinu Nigafim Lifneihem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu yishmor v'yatzil et chayalinu mikol tzara v'tzuka mikol nega u'machala. V'yishlach bracha v'hatzlacha b'chol maaseh yedeihem. Yadber sonenu tachteihem v'yatrim b'cheter yeshua u'v'ataret nitzachon. V'kuyam bahem hakatuv ki Adonai Eloheichem haholech imachem lehilachem lachem im oyveichem lehoshia eschem v'nomar amen. Together. Achenu kol Beit Yisrael, hanetonim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam, bein bayabasha, uvein baavir, hamakom yirachem aleihem, v'yotziem mitzara liricha, umeafela leora, umishibud legeula, hashta ba'agala, uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Okay. Very famous, well, two things. And I'm sorry I gave a shiur last night, but I also gave a shiur to you guys on Monday, and I'm trying to remember. I really should listen to my recording if I said this already, but let me say it now. Zot Chukat HaTorah, Parah Aduma is considered the most chuki of all chukim. I sort of question that because there are a lot of reasons that are always given for chukim, and some of them are even stranger than Parah Aduma, but that's not the point. If you divide mitzvot into two broad categories, chukim, which we wouldn't come up on our own with, and they sometimes don't really make sense, compared with mishpatim, which are common sense mitzvot, where normal good people in any society would come up with them, like tzedakah, taking care of the poor, like honoring parents. These are not considered chukim, they are considered mishpatim. Paying for damages that you cause and a whole bunch of other things. Chukim like Parah Aduma, like Shatnez. I mean, why should you not be allowed to wear wool and linen together in a garment, but you could wear cotton and polyester without any problem? So those are the ones that are usually labeled as chok. Rashi, in the beginning of Chukat, says that not the value of a chok, not the purpose of a chok, but one of the let's say accompanying feelings about a chok, I'm missing the right word, is that when the nations of the world or the Satan, or sadly, I'm adding to Rashi, fellow Jews scoff and say, "Give me a break. That's weird. Why do you do that mitzvah?" Meaning, there are things that make sense to me, but there are things that defy my understanding and my reason and my logic. So we get scoffed at sometimes. Why do you do it? And Rashi's answer is to be able to lift your head high and say, I'm adding in parentheses, I don't really understand it either, but this is a decree from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I follow it because it's a Gezeirat HaMelech, the command of the king. And what I want to suggest is that really applies or should apply to all mitzvot. Why do you do chesed? I do chesed because it's kind to another person. Yes, but first, it sounds strange to put it like that. First and foremost, I do chesed because it's a mitzvah in the Torah and God commanded me to do it. I honor my parents because God commanded me to do it. I don't plow with an ox and a donkey together because God commanded me. And second, could be any reason. Plowing with an ox and a donkey is cruel to the animals who are harnessed together but have different temperaments. Is that why I do it? It's part of it. But the main reason for doing a mitzvah is it's a mitzvah. The main reason for following a halacha is because it's required. And the same thing goes for the prohibitions to avoid doing them because you're not allowed. So why don't I kill? I don't kill because it's not nice to kill somebody. Yeah, but we can't overlook the fact that it's one of the mitzvot in the Torah, and it doesn't take away from what we do. I've used the example in the past of paying someone who does you a service on time and not delaying wages. So you call a taxi, you take your ride. At the end of the ride, he says 35 shekel, and you pay him. Why did you pay him? Because that's what you do with a taxi. Taxi gives you a service, you pay him when you finish with the ride. But we have one other point to add to this, and it does not take away from the regular action, but it enhances it. It is a mitzvah aseh in the Torah to pay for a service on time. Something that I would do anyway, even if it weren't a mitzvah, even if I didn't have to, because in normal society, you take a taxi ride, you pay at the end of the taxi ride. But the dimension that can be added to it, that should be added to it, that should be somewhere in a person's mind when he's doing it, is l'shem mitzvah. Now, this leads me to another point that I've made many times, and I think it's important also. I don't know if you've done something for someone, and they say to you, "Tizkei l'mitzvot." I believe "Tizkei l'mitzvot" is a nice thing to say, but not instead of "Thank you very much." Thank you very much is something you do for someone who does you something. The fact that it could be a mitzvah is another aspect to it. I'm not saying it's more important, less important. It's different. It's another aspect. A kind act that gets a thank you also can get a tizkei l'mitzvot, but not instead of thank you, in addition to it. I remember growing up, as I'm sure most of us had the experience of thanking our mother for supper and saying Birkat HaMazon. Saying Birkat HaMazon is thanking God for the food that you have, but it's very important also to thank whoever prepared the meal for you and gave the meal. So it goes hand and ha in hand. But the other point was that sometimes we're not actively mindful that it's a mitzvah, and we should be. So it goes both to both things. Now, what I was saying about chok is the attitude of gezeirah hi milefonai. This is a command that I was given by God, and that's why I'm doing it. Should apply in some way to all mitzvot. And that is kashrut, and that's Shabbos, and that's chesed, and the hachnasat orchim, whatever. It does not take away from being a nice person when you're also recognizing that you're doing a mitzvah. Okay, comment. Otherwise, we will move on. Now, Rashi, in the beginning of Chukat, is very unusual. If you look in a Chumash, the standard Rashi commentary at the bottom of the page, or yeah, at the bottom of the page, is a word or a phrase. Not every word, not every phrase, but every once in a while, you will find a word or a phrase that Rashi comments on and his comment. You have that at the beginning of Chukat. It goes through the whole Perek with comments on many of the psukim, many of the words and phrases. And when Rashi finishes with that, he says, up till now, I've based my commentary on the understanding of the psukim and the halacha. But now, says Rashi, I would like to share with you the Medrash, mostly based on the teachings of Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan, I looked him up, was a contemporary of Rashi, maybe a little older than him, also from France. And obviously Rashi knew about his teachings. And then Rashi starts from the beginning of the Perek again and presents the Midrashic interpretation and understanding of the whole Parah Aduma process. The overriding theme of that is that Parah Aduma is an atonement, a kapara, an atonement for Chet Ha'egel. The Egel is the calf, and the Parah Aduma is the mother of the calf. And the halachic procedures that come with and from the Parah Aduma are an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. And Rashi makes a very nice case for that. Word for word, phrase for phrase, you see it. Aduma tamima, why is it totally red? And he gives an answer. And Asher lo ala aleha ol, it never had a yoke on it, gives an answer. And tamim, without blemish, gives an answer and an understanding and makes connections between Parah Aduma and Egel HaZahav until at the end of that Rashi, you are convinced that Parah Aduma is very strongly linked to Egel HaZahav as an atonement for it. But then you could say, wait a minute. Atonement means an atonement for a sin. Yes, Egel HaZahav was a sin. But what is the potion made from the ashes of the Parah Aduma used for? It's not used to erase sin, it's used to erase tuma, ritual impurity. It's not a sin to be tame. It's a sin, very serious sin, if a person is tame and goes into the Beit HaMikdash area. It's a very serious sin if a person is tame and eats some sacred food like the meat from a korban or a kohen eating truma or challah. That's the sin. But being tame is not a sin and is often a big mitzvah when you're talking about a chevra kadisha who prepares a body for burial or someone handling a mate mitzvah. So the beautiful analysis of Rashi based on Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan, linking Parah Aduma to Egel HaZahav works, but Egel HaZahav to being Tameh, we seem to miss something there. It goes, just misses. It doesn't match. Unless you look at it like this. Why is a dead body the Avi Avot HaTumah, the most serious source of Tumah, to the point where it could make a person Tameh without touching the body, just being under the same roof? I saw a video the other night of a live stream of a funeral that was taking place. One of the speakers was a Kohen. They had to bring a microphone outside the chapel so he could speak to the people listening, but not enter the room. Kohen can't become tamei to a body except for his seven relatives, and that includes tumat ohel, specifically mentioned in the psukim. Why is that so? If the body is the housing for a person's neshama during his lifetime, then when the neshama leaves the body should become zero. Or even more than zero, it should be respected, properly disposed of, if that's the right word, with burial, if that's the tradition. But why is it the ultimate source of tumah? And the answer is sin. Why am I saying that? If we did not sin, then the body, when the soul leaves it, would be neutral. Because there's a mashal that's given in the sources. There's a story of a princess who falls in love with a peasant. And the king maybe tries to break him up, but it doesn't work. And he's convinced that the daughter really is in love with this guy, and he's not going to be able to stop. This is just filling in the story. That's not part of the mashal. The king calls the peasant in for a private meeting, and he says to him, "Look, I'm giving permission for my daughter, the princess, to marry you, but you have to treat her like a princess, not like a typical peasant's wife." HaKadosh Baruch Hu took a soul and put it into a body, and in essence says to the body, "I am giving to you chelek Elokut, part of my essence." That's a term that's used for a neshama. It's part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence. So you, the peasant body, better treat the neshama properly. And treating the neshama properly means mitzvot, chesed, Torah. Mistreating the body is chet, sin. And therefore, since there is no such thing as a person who has not sinned, and you can't even include Moshe and Aaron in that category of no sin, especially because in this week's Sedra, we have God calling attention to their misdeed, which we'll get to. Because of that, God, so to speak, has declared that the body without the neshama is tameh, and the tahara of it is not just the mikveh, but it requires the sprinkling of the potion of the Pora Aduma ashes, and the water. The potion of that Pora Aduma ash is called Mei Chatat, the water of a sin offering, even though Pora Aduma is not a korban, was not done in the Beit HaMikdash area, was done across the valley on Har HaZeitim, and yet it has that feature of now we'll have to make it a three-step process. Pora Aduma to Egel HaZahav representing sin, which causes the body to have been declared by God a major source, the major source of tumah, rather than just like an eggshell or orange peel that could be neutral. We don't despise, we don't negativize the orange peel after we peel an orange, we just discard it. Or cook it with sugar and make orange peel, but we won't get into that. recipe available after this year. Anyway, hope you get the point. So, another way of looking at it is that once upon a time, a long time ago, human beings were meant to live forever. That's at least our tradition. That changed the day that Adam and Chava ate from the Eitz HaDa'at, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. On that day, God had warned them, you could eat from any tree in the garden, but not from the Eitz HaDa'at, because on the day that you eat from the Eitz HaDa'at, you will die. Now, the strange thing about that statement is that Adam didn't die till 930 years later, according to our chronology. So what do you mean on that day you shall die? So some want to suggest it means on that day you will change from being an eternal being to a finite being. And that's like a recognition of death whenever it comes. Then comes Bnei Israel, Matan Torah, Yetziat Mitzrayim, Kriyat Yam Suf, Matan Torah. When Bnei Israel stood at Har Sinai and proclaimed everything that God says, Na'aseh v'nishma, and they were spiritualized by the whole experience, it's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I'm going to try this business again of eternal life. Not with all human beings, because they already failed me, but with this nation. And for the first 40 days after Matan Torah, things were okay. And then came Egel HaZahav. Once Bnei Israel sinned with Egel HaZahav, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said the equivalent of, okay, it's not going to work now either. Death returns to all people, however long they live, 70 years, 80 years, 120 years or more. There will be death. Human life is finite. And that is accompanied by the declaration that the body is a source, the source, major source of tumah, because we let HaKadosh Baruch Hu down with sin. And it's not just the sin of the golden calf, but that becomes a representative sin, which we continue to be punished for. We were not wiped out, the 3,000 or so people who reveled with the calf or worshiped the calf or however you want to interpret it, they were struck dead. But the rest of the people were officially forgiven, but the sin didn't disappear. It was like a tax. You sin, you get 100% punishment for that sin, plus 5% extra because of Chet HaEgel. I don't know if that's easy to accept or not. You don't have to accept it literally, obviously, but the concept is there. Chet HaEgel showed only 40 days after Matan Torah that we have our problems. And it wasn't just that generation. I'm sure that you know someone, present company excluded, who occasionally might, or once in a while, do the wrong thing. Think about it. You might have to go through all the people that you know till you find someone who is not 100% tzaddik, but could be done. Comments, questions? Let's continue. I think I mentioned there are three mitzvot in this sedra. All of them deal with tumah and tahara. The first one is the mitzvah to make the Parah Aduma and its potion. That's not a command for each of us separately. It's a command for Klal Yisrael and is performed by our representatives, in this case, the Kohen, not necessarily the Kohen Gadol. Originally, it was Elazar, the Sgan Kohen Gadol, the Vice Kohen Gadol, and it could be really done by any Kohen throughout the generations. So it's also important to point out that mitzvot, the total sum of them, 613 in the Torah, are not all individual commands. You and I have to keep Shabbos, and you and I have to eat matzah at the Seder, but each of us don't have to set up the calendar. That's what the Sanhedrin does, representing us. We each don't bring korbanot twice a day and musafim on Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, and Chagim. Our representatives do. We have mitzvot among the 613 that only apply to a king. Write a second Sefer Torah to carry with you all over. Not a single one of us has that mitzvah, which means we're down to 612. And I say that a little facetiously because it's many mitzvot like that. So there are mitzvot that apply to the king and mitzvot that apply only to the non-king, and that apply to the Kohen and apply to the non-Kohen. That already leaves out mitzvot from everybody's list. There are mitzvot that apply only if you do an Aveira. So returning that which you stole is one of the 613 mitzvot, which only applies to a person who stole something. And it just goes on and on like that. How many mitzvot do each of us actually have to fulfill? In our time, without a Beit HaMikdash, the number has been suggested somewhere in the high 200s. And a lot of it is open to speculation, and a lot of it is situational. If a man doesn't have a firstborn boy, then he doesn't have the mitzvah of giving his bechor a double portion of his inheritance. And if a woman doesn't have the mitzvah of Brit Milah, but they're all part of the whole body of mitzvot. Now, by the way, this is better said to Ashkenazim than Sfardim, but the fact of the matter is that Ashkenazi women make a bracha, Asher kiddishanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu. God, who sanctified us with his mitzvot and commanded us, a lot of them, women are exempt, but they're still part of the command. When you say v'tzivanu al achilat matzah, that applies to men and women equally. When you say leishev basukah, you say, wait a minute, a woman is not obligated. She's exempt from sukkah. The fact that she chooses to do it and eat in a sukkah, let's say, Ashkenazi says, okay, if that happens, she should make a bracha also. Vitzivanu, how could a woman say, and God commanded me, leishev basukah, if I'm exempt? And sure enough, Sfardim say, good point. Our women don't make a bracha when they eat in the sukkah because they weren't vitzivanu. Ashkenazim define the word differently. Vitzivanu applies to men and women, all Jews. Whether you're obligated or exempted doesn't change the fact that you were commanded. So it's a nuanced difference which manifested itself in the Sephardi practice of not making a bracha when you're not obligated, and Ashkenazi practice to, yes, make a bracha when you're not obligated. I had a situation recently, and I didn't have a good answer, where a woman asked me, if she marries a Sfardi, does she have to stop saying the brachot that she's been saying on mitzvot that she's not obligated on? I don't have an answer. I thought it was a good question. went along with the question. I've been lighting candles for Hanukkah all my life. Do I have to stop when I marry a Sephardi? Because they only light one lighting for the house. And a lot of other differences. Okay, these are things that are handled in books and are handled when necessary on an individual basis. Okay, so the first mitzvah is make the parah adumah, meaning slaughter it, take its blood, sprinkle towards the Beit HaMikdash, burn the parah adumah completely, add certain things to the burning, take the ashes, put it into mayim chayim, that's not just mikveh water, but it's live, the water from a live stream, and you are making a potion. By the way, the potion that was made can now be diluted almost infinitely. In other words, however much a supply of the ashes from the burning of a full cow into whatever quantity of water they do it the first time, can now you take a couple of drops from that water and you put it into a whole gallon jug of Mayim Chaim, and you have a potion for Parah Aduma. It's almost limitless. That's why there were only nine of them so far in history. And there'll be a 10th one. And you don't really need more, provided the supply remains. In other words, in the Beit HaMikdash is a storage of the original quantity of water. You keep taking from that to make more and more and more. I guess you could put water back into it to fill it up again. And you have almost a limitless supply of mei nida and mei chatat. Those are two terms that are used. Mei nida, according to the Mefarshim, does not refer to a nida, a menstruant woman, but it refers to the sprinkling based on the word that's used in certain psukim, related with the same root as nida. Okay, now, second mitzvah is a mitzvat aseh that a person who came into contact with a dead body is tameh. Now think about it, that's a strange kind of mitzvah. Like, what do you do? I became tameh. Well, did I do anything? Yeah, I was in a room where there was a dead body. I touched the dead body, whatever. But what does it mean that there's a mitzvah called tum'ah? Shel mate. Ritual defilement from a corpse, a dead body. And in fact, the Ramban Nachmanides doesn't count that. He says there is a status called being tameh. There are many different categories of tameh. You can't call them a mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah to be tameh. And if it is, then it doesn't mean that that's the category of mitzvah. I don't know if I'm getting across. But the Rambam and Sefer HaChinuch say, mitzvat aseh, shenitztavinu lehitnaheg b'inyan tumat meit, kamosha tzivanu b'Torah. So Rambam, Sefer HaChinuch following him, count as a mitzvah in the Torah to act upon the rules of tameh. You became tameh, you can't eat kodesh. Now again, the fact that you can't go into the Beit HaMikdash area when you're tameh mate, or any tameh, is avoiding a prohibition. And that exists, a lo ta'aseh in the Torah, that you're not allowed to eat, a kohen is not allowed to eat truma if he's tameh. But the mitzvah, aseh, a positive command to behave according to the rules of being tamei sounds weird enough that the Ramban doesn't even count it. He says it's just part of the rules. And for some reason, which I don't really understand, the Rambam does count it. He wants to add a chashivut to the following of these rules. Now, practically speaking, a non-Kohen, and let's say a non-Levi also, called a Zar or Yisrael, can become tamei and stay tamei until he has to become tahor, for example, eating of Korban Pesach. For example, going Aliyah LaRegel up to Yerushalayim and bringing a Korban with him to offer in the Beit HaMikdash on the three festivals. So there, that's covered by other halachot, other mitzvot and other halachot. You have to be mitaher before you can do something that you're not allowed to do if you're tamei. But the fact that there is a mitzvah called mitzvah tum'ah shelmeit, I don't know if I'm right by introducing it that way as a little bit strange. But it means a positive mitzvah to follow all of those rules. And the next one, the third one, is even stranger. Mitzvot that may nida, the potion of the Parah Aduma, is mitameh Adam Tahor and mitaher Adam Tameh. Now, look at it first as a rule, not as a rule, but as a fact. The fact is that the person who collected the ashes after they cooled off from having burned the Parah Aduma and mixes them in water has to be tahor, and his actions of mixing the ashes with the water make him tameh, even though the potion that he's making is what makes tameh people tahor. That's the famous enigma, the famous paradox, the famous mystery of Parah Aduma, and the Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch count it as a separate mitzvah, a mitzvah that the potion of the Mei Chatat is mitaher tameim and mitameh tahorim. I don't know how to explain it better than that, which is probably not good at all. I tried looking things up. I don't know, but it's there. And again, maybe it's there for emphasizing that you have to follow these rules. You don't say, hey, wait a minute. I'm tahor and I sprinkled the potion of the Parah Aduma on a person who's tameh, and some of the drops from that sprinkling fell onto my hand. So you're telling me that the person on whom I sprinkled Efer Parah Aduma becomes tahor, and I become tameh because I came into contact with that same water. And I was tahor, so I become tameh. He was tameh, so he becomes tahor. The answer is yes, that's the fact. And I guess behaving that way, not refusing to accept it, but accepting all of that thing, is part of this mitzvah in Parshat Chukat. Bottom line, Rambam, Sefer HaChinuch, three mitzvot from Parshat Chukat, all dealing with Tuma and Tahara, Tumat Mate. Other causes of Tuma have other mitzvot about one day Tuma and 7 day Tuma with korbanot, after without korbanot, with shaving one's hair in the case of a mitzora, and using the hair that was shaved from his head in the fire under the korban. These are all details, but these are the three mitzvot that the Rambam has. Question: when were we commanded originally to do the Parah Aduma? Or to put it in perspective, what happens right after this first portion in the parsha this week is Miriam dies. Miriam died on the 10th of Nisan, 1 year before we crossed the Jordan River and entered Eretz Yisrael, meaning it was at the beginning of the 40th year. Now go back before Parshat Chukat to Korach. When was Korach's rebellion? Korach's rebellion, there's a machloket as to whether it was right after Chet HaMeraglim, and that's gotten because Parshat Korach follows Shlach with Chet HaEgel, or was it earlier when the Levim were taken instead of the firstborns to become the workers in the Mishkan and in the future Beit HaMikdash? One way or the other, and there's a machloket, you're talking about the beginning of our 40 years in the Midbar. So you have Parshat Korach, beginning of the 40 years, Miriam's death, followed shortly thereafter by Aaron's death. In between them was speak to the rock, and they hit the rock instead, and water came back to the people. And everything that happened was at the end of the 40 years. So Parah Aduma is right in there. That's when we read about it in the Torah. So the question is, when did it actually happen? And I think all Mefarshim agree it certainly happened way before where we find it in the Torah. Some say that it happened, when I say happened, I mean commanded, right around the time the Mishkan was first built. Because you can't function in the Mishkan being Tameh. So you needed the procedure of becoming Tahor before you start working in the Mishkan. So most Mefarshim say it was from way back then, which would put it somewhere in the end of the book of Shemot. And then the question, which I don't have a good answer for, is why is it here in the middle of the book of Bamidbar? Probably, and I'm basing this on some suggestions of the Mefarshim, probably it's because we had just experienced at the beginning of the Midbar, we experienced a number of situations of death. The Chet HaEgel people and the Meraglim and those who complained about this and were 14,700 and 24,000 here and a whole bunch of other people and the personalities of Korach and Datan and Aviram and Miriam and Aharon, even though those are separate stories that are 38 years apart. This Parah Aduma business gets put in the middle to emphasize the function of the Kohen in that process and the implication for the purification of someone who came into contact with death, as the people in the Midbar had done, both at the beginning of their trip as well as towards the end. Because we're not finished. Between Miriam's death and Aaron's death, we have Many other deaths that were a result of the fiery, meaning poisonous snakes. And it just was an ongoing thing throughout the sojourn in the Midbar. So it finds itself here. To generalize that, you got to be careful to distinguish between when something actually happened and when we read it in the Torah. And those do not always match. And when they don't match, there's usually some kind of reason, whether it's easy reason to figure out or a difficult reason to figure out, is not the main part of the story. But the fact that is such. Okay. Comments or questions? So,
Yeah, what about Nadav and Avihu? That time with before at the Korban Pesach, they had to have it.
exactly. That's why the Mefarshim say it had to have been done then. The first Korban Pesach was after the Mishkan was erected. It was 2 weeks later.
Right.
And the people who handled the burial of Nadav and Avihu, their cousins according to tradition, became Tamei maybe on the 8th day of Nisan. So obviously, when they come and they say it's not fair, we should miss out on Korban Pesach because we're Tamei, there had to have been a way already spelled out to them to become Tahor. And their question
Right.
was, yeah, but you're telling us that we'll become Tahor at night and we're not going to be able to eat the Korban Pesach. So we don't want to miss out on that. And that led to Pesach Sheni. So it had to be earlier. And I think the question is better than the answer that I tried to give. But this is where it is. It's in between the early years of the Midbar and the later years in the Midbar, year. And it highlights the fact that there's a huge gap of time where we have no idea what happened. I often, wonder in the 27th year in the Midbar, what happened? Well, people got up in the morning and they collected their mun and they made breakfast and some of them took a nap already and other people hard to know, went to a shir. But Torah doesn't tell us all of that. And I've told you, to me, the pasuk that really highlights that is the pasuk that says Avraham was 86 years old when he gave birth to Yishmael. Avraham was 99 the very next pasuk when God told him to circumcise himself. A 13-year gap that, he lived, did what he
Nothing
did.
about.
Not important for us to know it. So the Torah doesn't tell us it.
I have another question, which is why did the followers of Korah not learn from Nadav and Avihu about the bringing of the Keteres?
All right, that's not just your question. If you came upon that question, that's good because it's asked. And I recently asked it also. And I'm sure loads and loads of people have asked that question. The only thing I can say, based on what I saw in some of the Mefarshim, is they were honestly convinced that they had the right to do that. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's like a suicide mission. And maybe Korach convinced them.
They were also convinced they could do it.
I understand that. But, just because someone was convinced and failed doesn't mean that a person who now feels, but I'm different because I am legitimate. It's very, very hard. Oh, let me put it into a little bit of a perspective. There are two different major changes from Matan Torah until now in the Chumash. which are not reversible. One of them was God's original plan to transmit his word to every single Jew. We came to Moshe, the people at the time, and said, "Stop. We don't want to hear God's voice anymore. You tell us what God wants, and we will do it, but we don't want to die by hearing his voice more." God said, "Okay, I'm with it." And he made an irrevocable decision that on condition that the people listen to a Navi, starting with Moshe Rabbeinu and any Navi Emet, true prophet, when he says, Ko Amar Hashem, this is what God said, you have to follow it as if it came from God himself. That was the condition that God imposed by agreeing, in order to agree, not to burden the people with hearing his voice. Korach, says the Mefarshim, said, "I don't agree with that. I don't accept that. I feel we were all present at Har Sinai. We all heard God's voice. And just because there was a vocal complaint from the people, it wasn't from everybody, it was from whoever was afraid to hear God's voice, doesn't mean that I should be bound by that." And that, according to some of the Mefarshim, is what Korach was wanting. He was looking for a status equal to that of Moshe Rabbeinu because he also stood at Har Sinai. The fact is that Bnei Israel were told, "Okay, I'm not going to give my voice directly to you, but you'll listen to the Navi." Korach said, "I want to take that back." And he was wrong, obviously. The other irrevocable thing is the switch from a Bechor to a Levi. Now, think of it. I am a Bechor 3,000 years after the switch was already made. So I do not have any strong feelings of being cheated out of not serving in the Beit HaMikdash, because I know that that's what the Kohanim and Levim do. But imagine the first generation where that happened. And imagine the feeling of disappointment and resentment on the part of some of the firstborns who, according to some of the Mefarshim, made up that group of 250 bringers of incense who said, "I don't want to give this up. This is what I was supposed to be doing, and I'm ready to do it. And I am totally convinced that it's acceptable." That sounds weird because we know what happened. But Nurith's question is very good otherwise. What would it, otherwise it's suicidal. How could you do it? And the point is also made that they didn't learn properly from the Nadav and Avihu thing. But that was different because Nadav and Avihu brought an Esh Zara, a fire that wasn't approved of from the Mizbeach. So these 250 guys said, "Oh, we're not going to do that. We're not going to bring our own fire. We'll take fire from the Mizbeach. So we're okay." But they weren't. That's the best I could do in explaining that. It's weird. It's weird. But these are two examples which I put together of irrevocable switches in the way things are. All the Bechorim in Am Yisrael can't get together and say to God, "We all do tshuva. We all promise not to do Averot anymore. Let us back to be the ones who work in Avodat Beit
Definitely.
HaMikdash." Okay, folks.
Regarding the getting the Paraduma, it's possible that they got it at Mara. Sham Samlo Chokumishpa Visham Nisahu.
Okay, which is before, correct, which is before Matan Torah even, and before the Mishkan. So,
Rashi's Bishalach.
right. Good point.
Because Rashi says that Chokumishpa he includes Paraduma.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Good Shabbos. Good Chodesh. Good Shabbos.
To you too.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.